Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, here we are in Central Florida and broadcasting along the Space and Treasure Coast. So obviously we're interested in all things spatial around here, and NASA's activities are of perennial interest. Recently, we had on someone talking about the Mars rovers, which are still up there going more or less strong after 6 years on the Martian surface. Today, we're going to talk about something different, both closer in terms of being in near-Earth orbit, but also looking much farther away. We're talking about NASA's Kepler Space Telescope. Probably everybody's familiar with the Hubble Space Telescope, which has been in operation for many years now and has made many amazing discoveries. Kepler's much newer. It was launched on March 6, 2009. And my guest today is William Baruchy, who is the Kepler Science Principal Investigator for the Space Telescope. Welcome, Mr. Baruchy.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for being on. He's at NASA Ames Research Center out in California, where a lot of projects like this are run. Well, this is a new space telescope. It's only been up a while, and it's already making some pretty fantastic discoveries. What is the mission of the Kepler Space Telescope?
The telescope and the photometer that it's part of is designed to find the frequency of Earth-sized planets. So it's looking for Earth-sized planets around other stars, and it's trying to find these planets in the habitable zone of such stars. So its basic mission is determine how frequent Earth-sized planets are among other stars.
So unlike Hubble, which is really doing a lot of different scans of the universe from different points of view, looking for different kinds of things over time, this has a much narrower, more focused mission, right? It's just looking for Earth-like planets around distant stars. Is that right?
That's pretty much true, but we, of course, find planets of all sizes, not just Earth-sized planets. Mm-hmm. In fact, the mission has just started out, so right now we're looking at the most obvious planets, which are the larger planets. As time goes on, we'll be concentrating more on the small planets because they're much more difficult to detect.
Are you looking at the larger planets to start with because they're easier to see and it's a way to test out the capabilities of the instrument?
That's right. We not only need to test out the instrument capabilities and its analysis pipeline, but we have to show that the ground-based telescopes that are also used in conjunction with this can do the job of validating what we have found with our space telescope, in that with our telescope, we're looking at over 150,000 stars constantly. And when we see a transit, a dimming of one of these stars because a planet's crossed it, it's possible that there might be something else that mimics that. So our ground-based telescope work follows that discovery and shows that, indeed, it really is a planet and not something else.
So you said, Bill, that you're looking at constantly at 150,000 stars. Does that mean, I think there are billions of stars. So are you looking at only at a single, fixed, narrow slice of the cosmos and focusing only on that?
I wouldn't call it narrow, but certainly we don't look at the entire galaxy.
Okay.
We are looking at our galaxy rather than some other galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at one portion of it. The size on the sky, if you were to hold out your fist at an arm's length, it would be that much in terms of the stars covered.
Hmm.
And in fact, in that area, are 4.5 million stars that we have cataloged ourselves prior to launching the mission. Of those, we've chosen just the best stars, the stars most likely, most able to show us small planets like that of the Earth. And we look at those constantly for the entire mission. We don't move the telescope.
Is this thing in geosynchronous orbit or near-Earth orbit?
Actually, in neither, and that is to say it does not orbit the Earth at all.
Huh.
It orbits the Sun, just like the Earth does. The Earth orbits the Sun in 52 weeks. The spacecraft orbits it in 53 weeks. So each year, the spacecraft is a little bit further and further behind the orbit of the Earth, getting further away, making it a little bit more difficult for us to send the data back. But it does allow us to constantly look at the stars. So we look at the stars 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, because we're not near the Earth and we're not near its radiation belts.
Well, that explains it. That's what I was wondering, how you could maintain a constant focus on a certain segment of the sky and certain stars. So you're looking at about 150,000 stars, more or less constantly, and looking for certain kinds of things. So what do you look for? What's the search protocol that you look for that gives you evidence that there's a planet around that given star, for example?
Spacecraft does is it's like a giant camcorder. So it's always getting images. Every 6 seconds, it gets an image of all the stars, and it accumulates those images to 1 minute averages and 30 minute averages. And once a month, it turns around and points its high gain antenna at the Deep Space Network on Earth, sends all that information back. That information flows to the Space Telescope Science Institute, which archives it. It flows to NASA Ames Research Center, where we look at the data for each of these stars. We plot its brightness as a function of time. And if we see a little dip, that could be a transit. And we're looking for at least three such transits. Hmm. Three transits for any given star tell us that we've measured the orbital period twice. They should agree one with another to a part in 100,000. And that rules out spots on stars, because stars have lots of spots, and the spots are at least as big as a planet.
Yeah.
So we've got to stop. We don't want to be confused by the spots on a star. So we're looking for at least three transits for any given star. So we're accumulating this data, plotting up the light curves, looking for transits.
So you're looking for indications that something's crossing across the face of the star and occluding or cutting the light it emits, right? And on a regular a measurable basis, that then is evidence that there's some object orbiting that star. Is that more or less right?
Exactly right. And the bigger the dip, the bigger the planet.
Okay. So what have you found so far?
Well, it's a mission, of course, that explores a part of phase space that no one has looked at before. So we see a lot of things. Certainly with respect to planets, in the first 10 days of data that we looked at, we found hundreds of planetary candidates, signals that might be planets but need to be confirmed. We found many hundreds of eclipsing binary stars, that is, double stars that eclipse one another, and thousands of variable stars, all of which are of interest to us. The 100 or so planetary candidates we've begun looking at with ground-based telescopes to see if we can make sure that we have a real planet and not something that mimics a planet, something we call a false positive. It might be a target star that we're looking at, but behind it's an eclipsing binary star that makes a small signal. Or it might be two stars that graze one another. So we've got to rule those out, and those are ruled out by a very vigorous and lengthy ground-based program at the world's biggest telescopes. So we have announced about a week ago 5 new exoplanets that have been discovered.
Hmm.
4 of these are somewhat bigger than Jupiter. One of them is quite a bit smaller than Jupiter, but bigger than the Earth. It would be sort of a Neptune-sized planet. And that's, as I say, important in several ways, one of which is that when we find these giant planets and we find Neptune-sized planets, we're talking about different kinds of planets. We have gas giants, which are mostly hydrogen and helium. And when we found these 4, one of the things that we noticed was that it was below the theoretical line. In other words, theoretically, you can calculate how dense such a planet must be, and if it's made out of hydrogen.
Yeah.
And the planets we're finding are less dense than theoretically possible.
Hmm.
In fact, one of these planets is so light, so low density, that it would not only float on water, it's low density as styrofoam. It's like a styrofoam planet.
Wow.
It's that low a density. It's one of the lowest densities ever found. Water has a density of 1 gram per cubic centimeter.
Yeah.
Earth is 5, and this is 0.17. So basically the density is styrofoam.
Well, do you think it's entirely a gas planet with no rocky core at all?
Yes, that's right. We believe this is a gas giant planet, whereas the Neptune-sized planet we found, the density is quite a bit higher, indicating it's probably a mixture, hydrogen, helium, and rocky material. Material like ourselves, carbon and oxygen, nitrogen, and silicon, and so that it's an intermediate kind of planet. We're not sure whether it has a rocky core, in fact. It might have a core that's sort of a fluid mixture of things like iron and carbon and nitrogen. We don't know. But we're trying to understand these planets, and of course we'll go on from those planets to planets like the Earth, which are mostly rocky planets, which have very little hydrogen and helium.
Gosh, that's strange. I think we all tend to think of planets as being like the planets in our solar system, which I think are all rocky planets, right? And so it's funny to conceive of a planet larger than Neptune size that's all gas. I mean, I don't even know how that would hold together. Does it have enough gravity to maintain a more or less spherical shape? You'd think it would be sucked into the star nearby and just be incorporated into its gassy environment or whatever. So What shape is a gas planet like that? You've got me intrigued now.
Gas planets are very much like a Jupiter or Saturn. They're all very round, but of course many of them spin rather rapidly, so they become quite oblate. In our solar system, we have three kinds of planets. We have the rocky planets like Earth and Mars, Venus, and Mercury. We also have what we call ice giants, which are Neptune and Uranus, which are this mixture of hydrogen and helium, but they have a lot of rocky material in them as well.
Yeah.
And then we have the gas giants, which have very little material that's rocky, or carbon or nitrogen, any of those things, much more like Jupiter and Saturn. They have a little, but not a lot.
So when will you start looking for the smaller planets, now that you've kind of calibrated your instrument against Earth-based instruments and figured out what it can see and can't see? When will you start doing what, I guess the core mission really is to look for Earth-sized, Earth-like planets? When will you start doing that, do you think?
That started actually during commissioning. That is to say, we look at all these 150,000 stars, and we record the data from all of them. Now, if there's a small Earth in it, it's buried in the noise. But if you get two or three or four transits, then those add up, and they come up out of the noise, and you detect them. So the data on Earth is already being accumulated, but it hasn't come to the point where we can find them yet because they haven't come up out of the noise. On the other hand, we do see some small planets, and not quite the size of Earth, but maybe super Earth, possible. These are candidates. What we find is that when we look at maybe 100 of these candidates, about half of them or something like that turn out to be false positives. They are something like an eclipsing binary star that's near our target star, but it's so dim that it shows a very small signal added to the star. And so we can't tell them apart yet. We need to look generally for the order of a couple of years before we say, yes, we found an Earth. And then, of course, the Earth is more likely to be in a short-period orbit, close to the star, too hot to have life. A planet like the Earth, in habitable zone, goes around the sun in 1 year. Since we need three transits, we need to look for 3 years, but the data is already there for the first transit for many of these things. It's just we can't find it yet. It's still buried in the noise.
Okay, gotcha. Well, you found a lot more than the five that you've announced so far, but the others are still kind of being analyzed. Well, Bill, these weren't the first exoplanets, as you called them, that were ever discovered. You know, were planets being found by Earth telescopes and maybe by Hubble in the past?
Most of the planets that have been found, the exoplanets, there have been over 400 found.
Okay. Wow.
Most of those are found by Earth-based systems. The radio velocity technique has been very, very good. We look at the wobble of a star, and you see that as it wobbles back and forth, that means there's a planet orbiting it. And so that's found the majority. And in the last few years, people with small telescopes, with sort of big photographic lenses, look at these stars, and they see these transits. But from the Earth, looking through the Earth's atmosphere, you can find Jupiters, but you can't find planets smaller than that.
Yeah.
And so they've been very prolific in the last few years in finding about 50 of these transiting giant planets. So that's where many of them come from. Prior to that, actually, a gentleman named Alex Wolfskin was looking at a pulsar, a star that had exploded and had its little core spinning around with a strong magnetic field, and he noted that signal that he was getting kept changing phase back and forth, and so he was able to detect that even though the star had exploded, there were still some planets around it.
Well, so I gather that from what you're saying that it's been easier to find giant planets, and who's to say if some of them might be habitable, I guess, or at least by forms of life different than those we know, right? But I gather then that nobody has found or at least confirmed an Earth-like planet so far, although there are strong indications that they exist, and everybody, I think, on a common sense basis assumes they do, right? But nobody's confirmed one so far. Is that true?
No, we have not confirmed any Earth-sized planets, and we don't expect to do that for quite a while.
Yeah.
We still have a lot of analysis to do to find these small planets. The smallest planet that we have confirmed at this point is a Neptune-sized planet, which is four times the size of the Earth.
Right, but I mean, nobody, even aside from Kepler, there have been Hubble and no one else, no other instrument, Earth-based or space-based, has found an Earth-like planet that's been confirmed, I guess. So what?
You need to think about what you're saying for a moment, and that the Earth is sort of a planet about a certain size, and it's mostly rocky material.
Yeah.
And people have found a rocky planet that's about maybe twice the size of the Earth, seven or eight times the mass of the Earth, but it's extremely hot. It's a couple thousand degrees Kelvin, So it's very close. It has a orbital period of a couple of days. So it's an inferno. Hmm. Nevertheless, it is roughly the size of the Earth, and it's a rocky planet.
Okay. Well, I mean, that gets into something that's, I don't know, quasi-philosophical and quasi-scientific, I guess, as to what are the criteria for supporting life. I mean, if you're talking about us, humans or mammals or even any life we know on Earth, it's going to be oxygen and water and, you know, maybe carbon dioxide, but in a certain temperature range, right? But how do we know that those criteria describe the full range of requirements for life? We don't really, right? So what do you think about that?
Well, certainly when we've gone to space, whether by telescope or with, you know, spaceships, we've always found enormous number of surprises. And in the planetary systems, that's certainly been true. We knew, we thought we knew, many years ago how planets formed. We were wrong. Space telescope has shown us that planets don't form by near collisions, which is what was commonly believed at the beginning of last century, 1900s. Hmm. We found with Hubble Space Telescope there were lots of planet-forming regions around us where planets were being formed. We saw the disks. So we knew that our theory had to be planet disks form around stars, and they form planets ultimately. Then we believed that all planetary systems would be like our own, that they would have rocky planets where the Earth is and Venus are and Mars are, and the Jupiters, the big planets, the giant planets, they would be way far out, 5 astronomical units further out. But that's not what we found. We found there were lots of Jupiters. They were inside the orbit of Earth, inside the orbit of Venus, inside the orbit of Mercury. Orbital periods not like the Earth of 365 days, but orbital periods of 1 day, 2 days, 4 days, a week. So a huge surprise. Similarly, we knew, or thought we knew, that all the orbits would be pretty close to round. Well, most of the orbits aren't round. They're very, very elliptical. So every time we look, we're surprised. And so when people say, well, certainly you'll find Earth, that is what we, you know, what we believe until we have any evidence. We have to go out and get the evidence. And the evidence up to now has always surprised us. So it's quite conceivable that Earth might form, or maybe they don't form, or that they're swept into the star. When you form a Jupiter out where Jupiters form, you know, quite a long ways out, but there's lots of ice and gases to build these giant planets, they come spiraling in. They move through this accretion disk like a boat does on water. A boat makes a wave when the motor's on, and that wave is extracting energy from the motor from the boat. So this big planet is moving through this, making a wave through this accretion disk, so it's falling in toward the star. But it's so big, destroy all the little planets ahead of it, like Earth. And so when it gets to orbital periods inside Earth's orbit of 4 days, it's cleaned out everything in its path. And so when we find these Jupiters, we might be seeing star systems and planet systems where there are no Earths. We just don't know. It's conceivable, of course, that the Earth then formed after that, and a big planet falls on the star. We just don't know whether there are any Earths out there or not. We all hope there are, but we're not sure.
Well, as you say, in all explorations, we find something unexpected, and that's kind of the nature of discovery. And, you know, it's true of whether it's planetary exploration or microbiology or you know, oceanography or oceanology or whatever. I mean, wherever you go where you don't know things and you start finding new science, new facts, you often find things that are really surprising and often things that fly in the face of established dogma and expectations and even, you know, established laws, you know, whether it's Newtonian mechanics or whatever, right? So I think it's probably a given that the more we explore out into the cosmos, the more we'll find things that are amazing and surprising, right? So it wouldn't be all that surprising to me if you found, I don't know, some sort of energy life forms that could exist in extremely hot environments that would be totally incapable of supporting life as we know it, but just it's just life as we don't know it, right? So I suspect as a scientist that wouldn't astonish you too much either, maybe, huh?
It certainly wouldn't, because you're right. We're always surprised, certainly with respect to life. I don't think anybody expected to find life at the bottom of the oceans where the vents were and where the water was 200 centigrade, you know, double the temperature of boiling water.
Yeah.
Expect to find life when we drilled oil wells and found there were bacteria down there. So you're right. We don't know what to expect other than it probably will be a surprise.
Those are good examples. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Bill Borucki, who is the Kepler Science Principal Investigator for NASA's new Kepler Space Telescope that's orbiting the sun and looking at about 150,000 stars to try to find planets, in particular Earth-like planets. And the underlying reason for that is to search for extraterrestrial life. So, Bill, what will happen down the road, a year or two, when Kepler does find some potentially life-supporting planets of the type that we recognize as being definitely able to support life as we know it? What will go on then? What will gear up and happen?
Well, certainly we'll all be very, very excited to have found such planets and truly delighted because, as I say, we're not really sure they are there. So that would be a wonderful discovery. But after that, we need to think about the next step. When we think of Kepler, we're thinking of a step toward exploring our galaxy, trying to find life in our galaxy. So the first step was taken years ago where people started finding planets around these stars. Kepler is the next step. It says, what's the frequency of Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone? And if that answer turns out to be there are many such planets, then the next step will be another spacecraft that will be built and launched, and it will look around the nearest stars to look at the planets around those stars to see if they have atmospheres. Mm. And do those atmospheres have water vapor in it? Do they have carbon dioxide? Do they have oxygen? And if Kepler finds that's not true, that most stars don't have such planets, they're rare, then instead of building that instrument, the next step will be to build an instrument called interferometer, which is much larger, much more expensive, but allows us to look much further into space so it can find enough stars to look at their atmospheres, their planets, and determine whether there's oxygen and water vapor in those atmospheres. So that's the step after Kepler. Hmm. And there'll be a step after that, too, because nobody's going to be satisfied if you find a planet that has an atmosphere that has oxygen in it,
right?
Because you can make oxygen several ways. So you'll want to build a mission that can find out whether that represents life, or maybe our children, because we're talking about generations here. It takes many years to design and build these missions. That generation might decide to build a space probe that goes there with a television camera and gets closer and gives us pictures. We simply don't know what we will be doing 20 or 30 years further on, but we expect that generation by generation, we will continue to explore the galaxy, and Kepler will help lead the way in telling us whether there are lots of Earths that are nearby or they're much further away, and we'll have to build much more ambitious missions.
So I think you said that Kepler does have the capability to see, to determine, or to detect atmospheres around distant planets if it finds one that might have an atmosphere? Are there instruments on board that can see an atmosphere?
No, they're not.
Okay.
Kepler is just a simple step. Are there lots of Earths?
Yeah.
Are they around in the habitable zone?
Okay.
And at that point, another mission must be launched to go and find these atmospheres.
Okay.
Now, we do see Jupiters, and for the Jupiters that are very, very hot, we can tell that they have an atmosphere, and that's about all we can tell. And that's just these huge planets which are too hot and all gas, so we don't expect any life on those.
I sure hope you do find some, and that I hope that we have the will and the money left in that future time, which may not be too much in the future. Hopefully you'll find some pretty soon. The will and the money to build another mission with the instruments that it'll take to take a closer look at planets like that. So, you know, as I said earlier, and I think it's true, the underlying driver for this Kepler mission is to search for extraterrestrial life. I was kind of amused to note that even the Vatican in Rome has gotten in on the act and held a scientific conference in November of 2009 about the possibility of extraterrestrial life and I guess how that would impact religious liturgy and dogma and so on. But it's kind of interesting that the Vatican seems to be an oxymoron that they would have a scientific conference. But I think that even as far back as Galileo, who was hauled before the Inquisition a couple of times and chastised for his beliefs that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe, the Vatican has been interested in science to one extent or another, even if it's defensive. And so that was kind of interesting that they're looking at that prospect. Is the Kepler project connected with SETI within NASA, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which has been going on using radio telescopes for many, many years? Are you in communication with them somehow, or is that just come later in case you find something you can target them at?
Well, certainly the SETI program has gone on for many years. They're entirely separate from the Kepler mission.
Right.
On the other hand, some of the people who have been interested in SETI or participated in SETI are members of our team. Joe Tarter is a member of our team. Carl Sagan used to be a member of our team.
Oh, really?
And we have a number of people that work for SETI that also work for us. And clearly when we find planets that are Earth-like, they will certainly target those. But that is not our goal. Our goal is just simply to find these Earths and tell people about them.
You know, it's interesting that as ambitious as the Kepler project is, this big new space telescope, it just hasn't had the publicity that other planetary exploration missions like the Mars rover that I mentioned at the outset of the show or the Hubble telescope have had. You know, those are almost universally known. And gosh, I think until maybe a few days ago, I'm thinking it's fair to say that most Americans hadn't heard of the Kepler telescope, which was just launched last March and has now found, you know, five exoplanets around distant stars. And yet, I think that Kepler, in the end, could be the most important project yet in terms of finding the kind, making the kind of discoveries that are important to the average person in terms of, gee, there are existing other Earth-like planets out there. Why do you think that? Do you have any idea? I mean, if from being on the inside of the thing, do you have any idea why it has not sort of received the really widespread publicity that some of those other missions have? Maybe it's just too new, huh?
I think you're right, too new. But you know, we need to always distinguish between talking about a future accomplishment and accomplishing something.
Yeah.
The Hubble Space Telescope has accomplished an enormous amount of wonderful science, wonderful images that we couldn't have imagined before. The rovers are on Mars, exploring for life. They are there. We're not talking about something to be done in the future. It's something that's been accomplished. Up to now,
yeah.
Kepler was, we will do this in the future. It's only in the last few weeks that we have actually accomplished this. We have found planets. And in fact, even prior to this accomplishment, there have been quite a few groups that have appreciated the mission. We were interviewed by Wired magazine. We got awards from Popular Mechanics, Popular Science, at the AAS meeting, the American Astronomical Society meeting.
Mm.
We were the first lecture on Monday morning when people had to get up first thing in the morning. There were 3,000 people that showed up to hear what Kepler had found. So we are getting the recognition now that we have accomplished something, which I think is, which is, to me, what is fair. Show me that you've accomplished something, and then get your crown.
Well, that makes perfect sense, and I think that Kepler is set to accomplish a lot more in the future from the sound of it. I sure appreciate you being on with us, Bill Borucki, to talk about the Kepler Space Telescope and what it's found and what its prospects are for further explorations and discoveries. Appreciate you being on.
Thank you, Court. I enjoyed it.
Thanks to you all for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.